Hello, hello, welcome back to Loki's Library, and if you are new here, welcome. I am your librarian, Katrina, and this is where I am reading through the enormous library books that you see behind me, and then I give you a quick synopsis and tell you what I think about them. So if you like books, just aren't sure what to read next, hit that subscribe button, like and share my videos, and let me know what you think in the comments. Now, last week's book, and kind of this whole month, I've been talking about like the Great Depression, economics, things that happened there. Last week's book was all a Twitter over how great Keynesian economics are and the firm belief that if FDR had gone further down the road towards Keynesian socialism, then the Great Depression would have been stopped in 1933 when FDR took over. This week's book, The Failure of the, quote, New Economics, An Analysis of the Keynesian Fallacies by Henry Hazlitt, thoroughly debunks that belief. And the accompanying cocktail is called Secret Satire, the reason for which I will include at the end of this review. It is 40 milliliters of bourbon, 10 milliliters of Poitain, 15 milliliters of Italian aperitif wine, and 10 milliliters of simple syrup. I think it's pronounced Poitain. It might also be Poitain or Poteen. There was a couple of different pronunciations online. It's an Irish liqueur that, let's see, what is it? What is Poitain? Triple distilled in pop copper stills. That the malted barley triple distilled in copper pot stills and cut with Irish spring water. Okay, let's do this. Let me start. I don't want to like tied it out. Where are you? Okay, so we'll start with the bourbon here. Now, let me start by saying that Henry Hazlitt undertook an absolutely Herculean effort to read through John Maynard Keynes' book, The General Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money, and attempting to untangle this mess the Keynes had put out there. And it is a hot goddamn mess. Hazlitt goes chapter by chapter. Where's my milliliter markings on this stupid thing? He goes chapter by chapter through Keynes' book, locating everything that Keynes got wrong, some things that Keynes actually got right, and, oh my god, typos everywhere. That's the wrong right to use in that situation. Everything that Keynes got right, and some things that Keynes almost gets if he would just understand some basic terms of economics. Terms like savings, which seems pretty straightforward, and investing, which maybe not as straightforward to the average American. But Keynes seemed to simultaneously believe that they are both the exact same thing and that savings is bad while investing is good. I myself was very confused by this logic. Let me see if I can... You know what? Let's just, so we're all clear, let's go to investopedia.com. All right, so we know what these terms actually mean. Savings refers to the money that a person has left over after they subtract their consumer spending from their disposable income over a given period of time. And consumer spending means everything from paying for housing because you're consuming the residence you're living in, to food purchases, the wants that you need, the wants you have like television, and the needs you have like food, right? That's all consumer spending. And then whatever is left is your savings, right? It's money that you have left over. So savings, therefore, represents a net surplus of funds for an individual or household after all expenses and obligations have been paid. That's what savings is. That's the recognized, acknowledged meaning of the word savings by economists pretty much everywhere. Investing, broadly, is putting money to work for a period of time in some sort of project or undertaking in order to generate positive returns, i.e. profits that exceed the amount of the initial investment. It is the act of allocating resources, usually capital, i.e. money, with the expectation of generating an income, profit, or gain. So investing is where most people actually make their money. It's not from savings. Savings are bad as far as Keynes is concerned, and everybody should be spending themselves down to zero to do your part for the economy. Which, if you doubt that that is alive and well as an ethos, just go back to 9/11 when Bush said we should all go shopping so that the terrorists don't win. That's basically what Keynesian economics is. Go spend all of your money. The Italian aperitif wine can be anything that qualifies as such. Campari is what I had on hand, so I went with Campari for this one. Now, let's see here. Clearly, saving and investing are not the same thing, but Keynes seems to treat them as interchangeable, except for when he, you know, says that savings are bad and investing is good. But you won't have anything to invest if you don't have savings. He seems to skip that logical step. He introduces terms that make no earthly sense. For example, this is a quote from the book. According to Keynes, classical theory allows only for two possibilities, frictional unemployment and voluntary unemployment. And Keynes then introduces the idea of involuntary unemployment. Except, as Hazlitt points out, all unemployment is either voluntary or involuntary. Frictional can be voluntary or involuntary. Examples of which might be, involuntary, someone is terminated. Maybe you got fired for something. Or maybe the business you're working for shuts down. That's involuntary unemployment. Voluntary unemployment would be you quit. All right, or your family is relocating, so you have to leave your job and you're going to be unemployed while you look for a new one at your new location. That would be an example of voluntary unemployment. But there's no third level of unemployment, however much Hazlitt would like to make it seem there is. There is not. So, those are just some of the very muddy waters. I don't know what that was. That Keynes has introduced into the world of economics. And Keynes goes out of the way to muddy those waters as much as possible around very basic terms. And Hazlitt does everything he can to unmuddy the waters, which is really hard if you've ever tried. And basically all you can do is wait for the, you know, turbulence to die down. And Hazlitt held nothing back in his attempt, and he did a pretty decent job in debunking everything Keynes says. He does say right at the beginning that he feels kind of bad writing a book like this after Keynes' death. Right? Not that it matters. I think that Keynes was dead before Hazlitt became really into the economic scene, but I might be wrong on my timeline. But he felt bad about it because Keynes gets no opportunity to rebut what data Hazlitt provides. But after rooting through Keynes's work, I mean, he literally could not write the refutation that he did, because Keynes' work is so bad and confusing and misleading about everything. Simple syrup, about 10 milliliters. This is a stirred cocktail, so let me stir this. I did the thing again where I left the lid to strain this out upstairs, so now I'm just going to have to pour very carefully. This is technically supposed to be poured into a highball glass. I don't have a highball glass. Or I do, but I think it's dirty, so carefully pour this in here. A secret satire cocktail. So, chapter by chapter, he shuts Keynes' work down, including citations and references from economists from John Locke through Ludwig von Mises, F.A. Hayek, L. Albert Hahn, Benjamin Anderson, Pigou. I mean, basically anybody, any reputable economist that has written articles refuting one aspect or another of Keynesian economic thought, he locates it, adds the chunks that are relevant to the specific thought he's in the middle of debunking, and explains why Keynes is wrong. And he doesn't, like, misquote Keynes. He literally takes huge chunks of Keynes' text and says, this is the page it's on in his book, this is what it says, word for word, exact duplication, this is why he's wrong. And it was a monumental task to write and to read. Okay, Joan Locke is kind of the exception here. Locke, whatever. Because he predated Keynes by a couple of hundred years. The only reason Locke comes into play is there's like one point on which he and Keynes seem to agree. But as Hazlitt points out, Locke, when he was writing, did not have the advantage of some of the great economic thinkers that came after him that refuted the point he was making, which is that interest rates are purely a monetary phenomenon. They are not. There's a lot that goes into interest rates, not just money. Well, that is an interesting flavor profile. One of the interesting points that stood out to me, and I tagged it specifically, is that in the last week's book, the author Robert S. McIlvain made the declarative statement that the Great Depression started in America with the stock market crash. And that was conclusively proven wrong. This is a direct quote from the book. The condition of comparatively stabilized unemployment existed in the United States from about 1931 to 1939. It began sooner than that in Great Britain from about 1925. So if unemployment was one of the metrics of the Great Depression that was a global phenomenon, then we have some, not just that, but the wild rampant inflation in Germany in the 1920s was also a massive part of that. So in both cases, a depression was exacerbated by frozen wages. It turns out Hoover placing a wage freeze on people was the absolute worst possible thing he could have done.
the other side of that coin were the unions refusing to accept lower wages. This was a two-party fault here. The government for freezing the wages, the unions for allowing the freeze to stand and not being willing to accept lower wages temporarily to pull the general market out of a slump. There's a lot more to it than that, but that's a very rough, like, dummy down version of it. Now, additionally, and I did not know this, and I do not know if this is still true, because this book was written in 1958, so I don't know how union contracts have changed in the last 70 years. But when this book was written, union contracts included a bit where union wages adjusted with inflation. So as the dollar, you know, as inflation occurs, union wages rise to match that. That's actually feeding inflation. It's not helping anything. So at least, now again, I don't know if that's still true. It's been 70 years since this book was written. That may have changed some. If that's the case, if it hasn't changed though, then that certainly isn't helping everything that's going on these days. Because that wage lock encourages a perpetual state of inflation and prices never stabilize. We are seeing that now, which makes me, why I kind of wonder if that's still true. This book was a bit of a slog to get through, not because Hazlitt is unclear. He is crystal clear in his explanations, but because he has to include those large tracts of Keynes' original text, right? Because otherwise people say, oh, well, you're misquoting him. You're taking him out of context. Well, he leaves as everything as contextually in place as he can. And it is agony to try and read through. Like, my eyes would gloss over. And I imagine this is probably true of most people who read it. Their eyes gloss over and then they think, oh, this guy must be really smart because I don't understand what he's saying. Or maybe he's just, maybe he doesn't know what he's saying either, and so he's trying to make it sound like he's smarter than he actually is. That is also a possibility that never seems to occur to people. I mean, I actually developed a theory of my own while reading this book, but it's more about philosophy than economics. I think that Jean-Paul Sartre, the founding father of postmodernist thought, probably read Keynes's general theory and thought, that's it. If I write a confusing amount of bullshit that says absolutely nothing but uses a lot of words, people will think I'm super smart and canonize me. And followed Keynes' lead into writing a bunch of bullshit that would get his name immortalized for writing a bunch of confusing bullshit. It's very roundabout. The final puzzle piece that kind of made my eyes go big and my jaw hit the floor is not so much that Keynesian thought has become the poster child for Marxist socialism, although it's certainly been used to say, hey, yes, this could all work. It's that what Keynes is given credit for, his grand contribution to modern economics, is positively medieval. All right, and I mean that literally. That's why it's the failure of the new economics, right? That's in quotation marks. Literal sense. He advocates a return to mercantilism, which was the economic school of thought pre-Adam Smith, roughly 15th, 16th century up until the 18th century. Mercantilism was the name of the game. And Smith wrote about laissez-faire in the 18th century, so mercantilism ruled the day before that. So all through the, late Middle Ages, led to many of Europe's wars. I mean, like, literally all the wars from the fall of Rome up until America embraced Smith's laissez-faire were ultimately the result of mercantilism. So what is mercantilism? So returning to investopedia.com, we get mercantilism was based on the principle that the world's wealth was static, and consequently, governments had to regulate trade to build their wealth and national power. Many European nations are tempted to accumulate the largest possible share of that wealth by maximizing their exports and limiting their imports via tariffs. So he advocates actively for a return to a system that led to lots of war and death, which flies in the face of another famous economist, Frederick Bastiat, when goods cross borders, armies don't. If you're trading with somebody, you're less likely to go in and try and steal their shit or tax them into submission and oblivion. Before I close out, the reason that I went with the secret satire cocktail for this one is that there is some debate if towards the end of Keynes's life, did he recant his general theory? And he didn't, not quite. He made some noises like maybe he was going to, but died before he did. Now, throughout Failure of the New Economics, Hazlitt says that he can't tell if Keynes is joking or being intentionally obtuse. Like, multiple quotes, he's like, I can't tell if this guy is serious about what he's saying, or if he's being deliberately obtuse, if he's joking, is he being satirical, is he being tongue-in-cheek? And at the end of his book, at the end of his discourse on Keynes's book, Hazlitt says, and this is a direct quote, "Keynes was a brilliant man. Much of what he wrote with tongue-in-cheek for the pleasure of paradox to epater la bourgeoisie, in the spirit of Wilde, Shaw, and the Bloomsbury Circle. Perhaps the whole of the general theory was intended as a huge 400-page joke, and Keynes was appalled to find his disciples who took it all literally. Wit and satire are dangerous weapons when not used in the service of good sense." End quote. I kind of wonder that about that, and I think Hazlitt wondered about that too. What if Keynes's writing was purely intended as satire, a la the great Titania McGrath, Oscar Wilde, George Bernard Shaw, and Gad Sad, right? What if he meant to satirize this great socialist school of thought, and the Lemmings missed the joke and took it all way too far? Hence the cocktail, secret satire. It's secret. And I'm kind of choosing to believe that Keynes was a satirical genius and not an economic moron, and that all the political lemmings and wannabe economists who worshipped the ground he walked upon just didn't get the joke. Because to believe otherwise is to cry. And that's it for this week. If you liked what you saw, don't forget to subscribe. I'll see you guys next Sunday. Bye.